Hi, this is Amherst Eclectic, and we are on our second podcast in a series talking about whether obesity is linked to sexual abuse. And at this point, after the first podcast, we have established that obesity, what they're finding over time, and in places with, that they deal with bariatric surgery and they deal with counseling of the obese, they are finding out that it is very much linked to child abuse or sexual abuse trauma from child abuse, and that people, what they're doing with the fat or the weight gain is they're putting on a physical wall between them and the outside world. And they're trying to block out anybody wanting to come inside that wall or to come near them and, you know, abuse them in any way, sexually or mentally or physically. So now we're on to the next podcast here. And what they said in the article is that many survivors, meanwhile, they put on the weight in order to protect against future abuse. So that's basically what that wall is for. They're protecting themselves. Women that they interviewed said they felt more physically imposing when they were bigger. In other words, you know, like they could scare them. They felt their size, rightfully or wrongfully, helped ward off sexual advances from their abusers, man or woman. Another patient said physical abuse was a daily part of her childhood, and her mother called her Jezebel. Her father would paddle her and her other siblings if only one of them did something wrong. And when she was in her teens, her father refused her permission to go on a camping trip with her boyfriend's family. When she asked him why, he backhanded her so hard she flew across the room. That's just one case of the things that I read. And for that reason, I grew up not being able to say no to a man. And in adulthood, she was fine with the attention she drew from, you know, her romantic perspectives when she was single. But then when she got into a relationship, she would put on the weight so that other men would be less likely to be attracted to her, to flirt with her, and try to lure her away from her partner. And she said, if I didn't want that extra attention from men, it was much easier not to get it if I was overweight. And I've often thought that's what a lot of people are doing when they put that weight on. It's that protective wall, that wall of, you know, I'm not going to be attractive for you. I'm not going to be somebody that you want. I'm not going to allow you to break into that wall that I have and hurt me. So this is what I'm doing. I'm putting up this wall so that you can't hurt me in the same way that you've hurt me in the past. Or maybe seeing that every man is just like that one man that hurt them before. And so they're putting up that wall to make sure that that person isn't going to get to them because they represent every man or every abuser that they've had in their life. So I, you know, I've just found it really interesting that that was actually something that was a part of what these people felt as an abuse, or how they were abused, the being overweight was a part of that. Another survivor echoed her perspectives. Eating and getting big, I felt like nobody would notice me. In other words, literally a wall that she was putting up against the world or to the world to say, don't look at me, don't notice me, you don't want me. So, interesting and pretty much on point. You know, I just remember thinking that every time that someone I would know would be obese, and they just would have this uncontrollable urge to always eat. And I inevitably, every single time, man or woman, I would find out that they had had sexual abuse in their past. Okay. People who have unexamined childhood trauma often fail when they attempt weight loss treatments. Some studies show that patients with histories of abuse tend to lose weight after bariatric surgery or during clinical weight loss treatment. Among women who were hospitalized for psychiatric treatment after bariatric surgery, one study found that 73% had a history of childhood sexual abuse. Gastric bypass prevents them from eating large quantities, thereby removing an essential coping mechanism. In the weight loss group, there was one woman, also a victim of abuse, who would come every week and sit silently. And this is the one I told you about, with a smile on her face. And one week she announced that her family had finally scraped together the $20,000 necessary for her to have the bariatric surgery. And the, you know, doctor was like, well, this is going to be a disaster. I mean, you could already see it coming. She'd lost 94 pounds, became suicidal, and was psychiatrically hospitalized 5 times the following year. And the doctor said the weight came off too quick. And that's what she said to him, excuse me, is that the weight came off too quick. I felt like I was losing my protective wall. Yeah, this was one of the things that I wanted to bring up. So they feel like they have a wall around them that is protecting them from this horrible monster, just kind of like, you know, liken it back to the days when we had moats around castles and there was a wall to protect them from the enemy. So obesity is really a wall of fat, a wall of unattractiveness, a wall of you don't really want me, you don't really want to come near me, because I'm bigger than you, or whatever, to keep people away. It also says, these women's stories suggest that obesity is not what it seems. Given how increasingly obesity risks, or given how it increases obesity risk, preventing child abuse could be considered a public health measure on par with mandatory calorie labels. Doctors may tell overweight patients to diet and hit the gym, but if they suffered childhood trauma, their bodies might be actively working against them. Worse still, the patient might consciously or otherwise have a dark reason for remaining heavy. Those reasons that they don't tell you. Those reasons that they're going to keep to themselves because it's so horrific that they don't want to talk about it. Eventually, the doctor incorporated a questionnaire before people were allowed to have the surgery that asked patients about their sexual abuse and other childhood trauma into his obesity program. Several obesity treatment specialists contacted for this story also said that they routinely ask their patients about sexual abuse. Most won't mention it unless they're prompted. So an obesity medicine specialist in New York said that the first question she asks patients who seek weight loss treatment is, did you have a happy childhood? People who did will say right away that they had a happy childhood. But those who didn't, there's usually a pause, and a vague explanation. If the patient recalls abuse, they might refer to the psychologist that they have on staff. Now, some doctors say that they struggle to secure insurance plan payouts for the extensive psychological or psychiatric treatment that abuse survivors require. About half of the psychiatrists don't take insurance, and half of the U.S. counties have no mental health professionals. This is what I was talking about before. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services covers 16 to 22 visits per year for obesity-related medical counseling, but psychological therapy is not included. With people who are abused, you have to uncover their awful wounds before they get better, says an internist at George Washington University who focuses on obesity. And at her hospital, psychiatry residents see many of her patients for free. And she's not sure how they would provide those mental health treatments without those residents' help. Some survivors find other unorthodox routine routes to restoring mental and physical health. Later in her life, the 93-year-old abuse victim began speaking regularly on abuse issues to groups of doctors, social workers, and police departments. The advocacy has certainly dulled the pain and given me a sense of pride in the fact that I have been able to run my disgusting story into a tool to help others. So because she's able to talk about it, she's able to vent it, then it has helped her. And I've said that about a lot of things, you know, when people are having just issues of any kind, that it's just really, it's healing to talk about it. Sometimes when you're talking about things and you're just going through it and your process isn't, it's coming out of your mouth. But first, you know, it has to go through your brain before it comes out your mouth, and you're processing what you're saying. And sometimes when you're done with the conversation, either you've processed it or it takes a few hours later or a few days later after you've talked to someone about it, you start to feel better. Or you actually, in the process of talking through what you've been through or what happened to you, or maybe even something that happened the day before, you begin to realize, like before you're even done with the conversation, you start to realize why you did what you did, why they did what they did. You start getting answers. And you're just like, wait a minute, I never thought of that before. This is why blah did blah did blah, you know, and you start processing all that. So I think for her, you know, getting up in front of people and telling her story over and over, which, you know, she never tells it the same each time, pretty sure of that, and getting questions from people, well, what about this? What about that? Why did you do this? Why did they do that? And how can we help people? You know, and her answering those questions has probably helped her to process and come out on the other side of things. And again, just talking it over and over in her mind and talking with people has probably brought her out on the other side, or realizations that she never even thought about because of questions people have asked, because she's, you know, not only got a physical, had put that physical wall up, but she had also put that mental wall up. Let's see. The woman who documented her teenage dieting and bulimia in journals was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder in her 20s. After suffering an anxiety attack, she called the health center at her college, which referred her to therapy. She would ride the bus to the therapist in the white immaculate office twice each week. And she said she used to refer to it as a paid for parenting. And she's now 49 and living in Massachusetts. She said the therapist was warm and welcoming. Eventually, though, she felt it wasn't enough to simply talk about her emotions. Her abuse had left her feeling like an amputee. Talk therapy was like retracing the question. How do you feel about the fact that you can't get up the stairs? When all she really wanted was a ramp. Metaphorically. In her 30s, she enrolled in a writing workshop, and she and dozens of other people, many of them survivors of trauma, would sit in a room and compose essays about their past and share their work with the group. At first, being open about her childhood felt awkward for her, but after each of the four sessions, she found herself feeling better for months. So that's what I was talking about, you know, processing it and really getting it out there. And then you don't realize until later that that's what you needed. You needed to talk about it. You needed to get it out. You needed to kind of figure out what happened. And then they say it was around the same time that she began regularly practicing yoga. And that too was fraught initially. For survivor of sexual abuse, lying down in a dark room with strangers, as most yogi people do, at the end of class was kind of scary for her. And gradually, though, the practice helped her once again feel safe in her skin. Decades later, the days of seeing her body as tainted were finally over. She still believes she'd be keenly sensitive to stress for the rest of her life. But now when something triggers her, like her home flooding a few years before, she turns to a relaxation technique called guided imagery to manage her symptoms. She's become an advocate for abuse victims, and in 2014, she opened her own writing workshop. She says the abuse will always tug at her, but today its power is diminished. That's just stuff that happened to me. And it isn't me. So, you know, that's why it's really important for these people to get the counseling, the psychological help that they need, that to be able to talk to a psychiatrist who is, you know, versed in what they need and how their brain functions and is able to tell them, you know, about the chemicals and how that reacts and why they constantly have this feeling of hunger, which we talked about in the first podcast, about, you know, why those chemicals react with the body and they put inflammation into your body, but they also make you, you know, never satiate it. You want more and more and more and more because you're dealing with that fight or flight feeling because, you know, you keep having the PTSD that brings back the fear and you never quite feel like you're out of it. You never quite feel like you're over it. So, you know, they continue, you know, like it says, if you think of the body as a clever organism, you know, it's exposed to something that's threatening and it protects itself by making sure that there's plenty of calories on board. So that's why a lot of people eat, you know, and there's another story here. I was trying to find it and I'm trying. Trauma that occurs during critical periods in the brain's development can change its neurobiology, making it less responsive to rewards. This anhedonia is what they're calling it, a deficit of positive emotions, more than doubles the likelihood that abused children will become clinically depressed adults. It also increases their risk of addiction. With their brains unable to produce a natural high, many adult victims of child abuse chase happiness in foods. It's this tendency, when combined with what many describe as a desire to become less noticeable, that makes this group especially vulnerable to obesity. So, like I was telling you before, with the guy that I knew, he was severely abused by his father. I don't think he experienced sexual abuse, but he actually told me that there was a time that he had gained a lot of weight, that he got really big, that he was obese. So he could understand, you know, the food addiction as well. Then he had to lose weight. He had to get in shape for himself. But he also had, you know, been with in a relationship and had two kids. He never got married. And he got out of that relationship. It was very upsetting. And, you know, he just kept relapsing. He kept having relapses with drugs. And he's talking about how he was in those houses where people were doing drugs and abandoned homes down in the city, you know, risking his life just to get a high. But I understood him more because he was telling me about the abuse and what he went through, and that he would wake up still in the middle of the night and feel like his father was abusing him because he was right back there. And he would just have that flashback, that PTSD. So I totally understood why he would go do drugs. Because for him, the drugs numbed him. They made him forget. And then he wasn't having those thoughts anymore. And that's why so many people can't stop. Because the reason they're doing the drugs is to forget. And then when they stop doing the drugs, then it all starts coming back. Those horrible nightmares start coming back, or those horrible flashbacks start coming back. But when they're high, when they're out of it, when they're, you know, doing the drugs, they don't have to think about it anymore. They can just forget. So same thing with a food addict, putting up the walls that they put up. And here's another story. There was a Maryland woman who was a victim of incest at the hands of her father, uncle, and cousin. And she would sometimes go for days without eating as a teen. So there's a correlation too between people who are obese to the correlation with people who are bulimic, or people who are anorexic. They're all the same thing. They all produce that same chemical in your body that releases the dopamine into your brain. Weird, you know, isn't it? It's kind of weird. When sometimes she would go for days without eating as a teen. Now that she's in her 50s, the pattern has reversed, and she finds herself prone to binges. When at the airport, for example, she beelines for snack shops, buys 2 to 3 bags of M&Ms and a pack of Cheez-Its, and downs it. And what I used to say about people when they were anorexic or bulimic even, the reason that they do that is they're trying to make themselves, they don't want to grow up. They don't want to become an adult. They don't want to become more sexual. Because if you know, as we all know, when a woman is really thin, she doesn't, you know, her breasts are not there because breast is mostly fat. You don't have much of a body shape. You don't have curves because curves are, you know, they're fat. That's what it is. But it's a natural thing for women to have, because that's why you're having the curve. You know, you develop breasts because breasts, basically, hate to break it to you guys, they're not your little fun toys. They are meant to give milk to a child when you birth a baby. Also, the fat that women get on their bodies, the curves, whatever, that is supplies for when your baby is born, that, you know, you're going to be able to produce that milk and you're going to have enough on your body to give to your baby when they need it. Okay. The trauma of sexual abuse often manifests through a preoccupation with food. Dieting and a drive feel uncomfortably full. One analysis of 57,000 women in 2013 found that those who experienced physical or sexual abuse as a child were twice as likely to be addicted to food than those who did not. So, yeah. There's your statistics on that one. Let's see. There was a 75-year-old former patient who saw the doctor when she was in her 20s and weighed 270 pounds. And she began eating compulsively after a childhood of horrific and sexual and emotional abuse. She and several others, sources requested to be anonymous during this, and the families and friends to be anonymous. Now she has a host of health problems like bone problems, tumors in her brain, a sciatic nerve that she believes are related to her weight and mental anguish. And she said it bothers you your whole life and it decimates you as a human being. And I could see that. I could see that's pretty, pretty horrible what these people go through and, you know, how it relates to, you know, their addictions. And what's this? Okay, it says it's bad to have a substance abusing parent or a mentally ill parent who's untreated, a psychiatric professor said. Of all the ACEs, which I guess that's the checkpoints for why people do these, why people have these addictions, sexual abuse seems to be the most pernicious. This is particularly true for women. Sexual abuse is about betrayal. It's occurring at the hands of a trusted family member or a caregiver. Studies by Putnam and others have found that sexually abused women are more likely to suffer from an array of seemingly unrelated mental and physical ailments, including premature puberty and problems in school. And this goes back, you know, I didn't even think about this before, but this goes back to when I was in school. I had a friend who I was very close to. She's very tall, and I, you know, I've talked about this on other podcasts. I actually went and spent the night at her house a few times, and she had been sexually abused. So, you know, it's kind of something that I have had in my life and thought about, and I've wondered, you know, what people, you know, why, what happens, you know, to people after they go through this. So we're coming up on another 30 minutes here on my podcast. If they always go longer than I think they're going to go. So I'm going to research a little more on the things that I have, on the articles that I found, and I will meet you on the next podcast, and we'll try to probably finish this up in the next podcast. So see you on the next podcast. This is series 2. That would make this next one series 3. See you over there.